Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 451. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. Back with our regular panel, we have with us Glenn Clary, who's the pastor of Providence OP down in Pflugerville, Texas. Welcome back, Glenn.
Thank you, Camden. It's great to be back.
Yes, and we also have his partner in the area, Jim Cassidy. Always love having Jim on. He's the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas, just on the south side of the same geographical area. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you with us.
Almost deep in the heart of Texas. Not quite, but we're almost there. It's good to be
You're
here.
You're in that liberal pocket of Texas.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, we're thankful to have you both with us today, and we're also very thankful to have with us another one of our regulars, our Vosk Group contributor, Dr. Lane G. Tipton. Lane is the pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania. He also teaches biblical and systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to have you on again off Vosk Group.
Hey, it is great to be here. I really enjoy this. Austin is weird, but it's still Texas, so it counts. I love it.
Lane did live there for a year.
Oh, yeah.
Great town.
Yeah.
It is a great town.
Keeping it weird.
Wonderful thing. Yeah.
We're keeping it weird, which means we're with her this year, unfortunately. But anyway.
Well, today we're going to be speaking about an important subject, looking at the Mosaic Covenant as a republication of the Adamic Covenant. In what senses we might say that, and in what senses we might not say that appropriately. This is building on the work of the Committee to Study Republication of the General Assembly of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. For those in the know, and I'm sure there aren't too many out there, but certainly a lot of our listeners are interested, the committee just submitted a report to the OP's General Assembly just a few weeks ago, and we're going to be speaking about that report. It's a very important report, one that's available now. It's about 100 pages, very thoughtful and very good work, and we're looking forward to unpacking some of this. But before we get into the details, I've got a couple of things to mention news-wise and update-wise. And as we have been in recent weeks, encouraging you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/conference for information about our upcoming conference, October 7th through 9th, 2016, here in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're going to have our annual conference once again, coming off the heels of our spring conference, our first time we were down in Austin, Texas in April. But in October, we're going to be hosting everyone once again here in Illinois, just north of Chicago, not too far from O'Hare Airport. And if you visit us online at the conference page, you can find out more information about our event as well as how to register. We have a lot of speakers. All four of us on the conference call today will be available, and we'll be here. We'd love to meet you. We're going to also welcome Jeff Waddington, working on some breakout sessions as well. So we're going to have a great slate of speakers all speaking about the image of God and how that pertains and relates to a whole host of other theological and practical topics. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/conference. While you're on the website, once again, please read our articles. We have usually one or two every week now, so there are many new things being posted, being written. So read some articles and comment and follow up with some of the thoughts and the really excellent posts that have been written recently. We have one on Psalm 67, Let All the Peoples Praise You, written by Dan Ragusa. So along with all of our podcast episodes, many of you probably subscribe either through iTunes or directly through your smartphone, whether that be an Android or iPhone, however you use it. I noticed through the statistics that a majority of people subscribe to the podcast through a podcast app. And that's awesome. That's the most convenient. That's how I do it. And then when I go running or biking, not really biking because that's not safe, but exercising, I'm always listening to podcasts. Or when I'm driving around, I connect to my car stereo through Bluetooth. And I imagine many of you do as well. The only issue with that is that if you're not subscribed to our RSS feeds with all of our written content, or if you're not visiting the website directly, then you're missing out on a whole host of great resources that we make available on reformedforum.org. So we'd love to have you with us. We'd love for you to read. We'd love for you to follow up, and we'd love for you to give us some more suggestions on some topics that we might address, but we need you to come online to do that at reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for visiting us and, of course, for their support. And we look forward to hearing from you soon. Well, brothers, we've got a little bit of a topic here that might seem at first hand as inside baseball. It's real heavy OPC, but certainly this is a topic that we can offer some theological leadership on. There are other denominations, and certainly the Reformed tradition as a whole is should and ought to be concerned about this issue, at least in terms of gaining some more clarity. It's a very important subject, especially when we dive into biblical hermeneutics and looking at covenant theology, how the different redemptive historical eras relate to one another, and just generally speaking, overall, what God's program has been and is for his people in terms of redeeming them and saving them. So we have here a General Assembly report written by this committee. It was delivered to the 83rd General Assembly, if I've got my numbers correct, but it comes on the heels of an overture and of a decision of the 81st General Assembly. Let me read to you a paragraph out of this report. The 81st General Assembly, in response to an overture from the Presbytery of the Northwest, elected a study committee, quote, to examine and give advice as to whether and in what particular senses the concept of the Mosaic Covenant as a republication of the Adamic Covenant is consistent with the doctrinal system taught in the confessional standards of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. The men who were elected to this committee were Brian Estelle, Benjamin Swinburdenson, Lane G. Tipton, Craig Troxell, and Chad Van Dixhorn. So we're going to look at their report and the product of their 2 years of heavy labor and study, and going to unpack this topic more specifically. Now, as we begin, we should offer just an overview of the report, maybe a context of why this came about, unpacking that paragraph. But if anyone's interested in knowing about the General Assembly more broadly speaking and trying to understand some of the broad contours, I do recommend reading Daryl Hart's report, the 2016 General Assembly, Nothing Out of the Ordinary. He wrote that in the latest issue of New Horizons. It's also available online. I've linked to it in the episode description. So if you just are curious about what went on at the assembly, that's a good place to start. But he's offering a general overview and a general assessment of the assembly as a whole. Today we're going to do a much, much deeper dive. But Lane, could I ask you just to provide in broad strokes to begin with the nature of this report, why it came about, and why this is an important issue?
Sure. You know, the issue arose out of a discussion in the Presbytery of the Northwest, really focused on this particular issue. What is the nature of the Mosaic Covenant at the national level in relationship to either the Adamic Covenant of Works or the Abrahamic and New Covenant, respectively? And in other words, If you're asking the question, what is the essence of the Mosaic Covenant, would you say that it is essentially a repristination, republication, representation of a prelapsarian Adamic covenant adjusted in some way? Or is it an organic continuation of the covenant of grace with a unique set of typological features built into it? That's kind of the way the at least the way the committee started to form the question, and that's what we were after. And I appreciate, I noticed in Daryl Hart's review here, he notes that there is this question about the Mosaic Covenant and its administration. And he says that the committee recognizes that there's a distinction between the administration and the substance of a given covenant. He does stop there and say that the summary, you know, he's giving might be difficult for some readers, and I understand saying that in the context of a New Horizons article. What we tried to do was ask the question, and this is the one way to focus it: what is the substance of the Mosaic Covenant at both the individual and corporate level? And that kind of occupied the central concern of almost every chapter. So if you're asking a question, how do I orient myself on reading this document? Well, the way to think about it is to say, is the substance of the Mosaic Covenant, are the delineating or distinguishing features of the Mosaic Covenant, is that a covenant of works or is it a covenant of grace? That's the way we were trying to get to it. Now, to give a little bit more context, in light of some of the discussions that have happened in the contemporary Reformed context, it seems that the distinction is between those who want to see the Mosaic covenant as, in essence, a covenant of works in contrast to a covenant of grace. Mm-hmm. And we tried to situate the report around that particular question and offer clarity in terms of A, how our standards speak about it, B, how our tradition has spoken about it more broadly, and C, we then tried to ask and answer the question, what would Meredith Klein's view be? Mm-hmm. And then we tried to draw a few conclusions after that. So the question is, what is the essence of the Mosaic Covenant? Then we ask the question from our standards. We ask the question from our tradition. And then more narrowly, because much of the discussions revolved around the theology of Klein, we ask the question in light of Klein's own theology. Yeah. So that's a kind of bird's eye view way to situate the structure of the report.
You know, for those people who haven't been able to see the report, it is available. We will try to link to that so people can also read it and look at it. One thing I very much appreciated when you first opened the report and start reading it is its structure. It's very clear in terms of laying out the impetus for the committee's work, what its nature was, what it was attempting to do. But also one thing that you as a committee have spent much time on early on is trying to clarify terms. Because some of the difficulty when we have a controversy or when people are discussing these theological matters is sometimes we can have different senses or understandings of the terms involved. And so this report takes great pains, it's said multiple times in there, to be very clear, crystal clear on the terms. And there is even a glossary at the end, which is quite helpful for some of these terms. Republication, etc., merit, you know, things like that. What do we mean here? And the glossary is very helpful in clarifying those. But Lane, as you've mentioned, the nature of the Mosaic Covenant, one thing that's been pointed out and perhaps is a good question is, why is there no definition of the Mosaic Covenant in the glossary? Seems like that'd be a good place for it.
Yeah, that does. You know, there are so many definitions there, and you're looking through it and you come to the M section and say, Mosaic Covenant, I can't wait. And it's not there. Well, that was intentional, and here's why. There are at least a couple of reasons. Number one, the entire document is aimed at clarifying the nature of the Mosaic Covenant in light of our standards, in light of our tradition, in light of the theology of Meredith Klein. And so the whole document is aimed at doing that. And secondly, and what readers will recognize as they start to dig into the document, there are two ways to cut this. You have two essentially incompatible notions of the nature of the Mosaic Covenant. It's either in substance a covenant of works, or it's in substance a covenant of grace. And within our tradition, there has been some disagreement on that. To put it a little bit differently, there are four different views of what the Mosaic Covenant is outlined in our taxonomy. Is it a covenant of works pure and simple? Is it a mixed covenant consisting of grace and works in some sort of relation, not always clearly specified? Is it a subservient covenant where a substantial works principle operates at the national level, relegating typical blessings? Or is it essentially a covenant of grace? The first three views would say in some way it is in essence a covenant of works, modified in certain ways. The final view would say it's in essence a covenant of grace. So we don't put a single definition in because we want readers to engage the nuances that exist within our tradition. We want the readers to engage the discussion from our standards, and then we want the readers to recognize the fact that while there is clarity here, that clarity cannot be reduced to a single definition given the nature of the report and the variety of views.
One of the things, I'll preface my question, I guess, with a comment. Just one of the things I found so very helpful about the report itself was the way in which it makes a distinction with regard to a works principle within the Mosaic administration between substance and administrative. So there's a sense in which a republication may be spoken about administratively, but not substantially. Would you be able to unpack for us that very helpful distinction? What was in the mind of the committee? Where did they get that distinction from? And perhaps unpack that for us.
Oh, sure. I would love to. Now, let me preface this. I'm going to summarize the whole document, and I'm going to try to honor the work of the whole committee. Any failure to do so rests squarely on the shoulders of Lane Tipton, his inadequacy as a theologian and communicator. And so whatever I miss in terms of detail, please let the readers know the document is very detailed and very helpful here. And my summary is just that, a summary. And I'll be selecting things here and there that won't give you all of the detail, or we'd probably be talking for 2 or 3 days instead of an hour. With that said, early on, I'm going to just talk in terms of the way this appears on the report itself. Around page 1810, we talk about the covenant of grace and the distinction between substance and administration. And the distinction, that there are ways to put this, but the substance of the covenant of grace is Christ, Westminster Confession 7:6. And the language of administration also comes from Westminster 7:6. There are not two covenant of grace differing in substance, but one in the same under various dispensations or administrations. So the distinction between substance and administration, when you're talking about the covenant of grace, is that you've got one covenant of grace administered in old and new covenants respectively. It is one in substance. It differs in administration. It's administered under the old covenant in promises, types, sacrifices, shadows. It's administered under the new covenant through the preaching of the gospel, and the administration of the sacraments. And the key is that Christ is the substance. Christ is the fundamental redemptive subject matter of the covenant of grace. And so when you think about the substance of the covenant of grace, you're thinking about Christ and Spirit-gifted faith union with him. That's at the core of the covenant of grace, whether it's administered in the old or new covenants. Law, old covenant, gospel, new covenant. So that distinction is there. And then the covenant of works, the substance of the covenant of works, is that perfect, personal, exact, and entire obedience was required of Adam as a federal head. So he did not need faith in Christ, and Christ himself was not the substance of the covenant of works. He is the substance of the covenant of grace. So that distinction between substance and administration is designed to help you recognize that between the covenant of works and the covenant of grace, there is a categorical, or what we might call essential, or even more basically, substantial difference between a covenant in which there is no redemptive provision supplied, covenant of works, and a covenant in which there is a redemptive provision supplied, covenant of grace, and the substance of that redemptive provision is Christ. That distinction kind of guides and regulates and informs all of the ensuing discussion within the confession.
In the introduction to the report, two other terms and concepts are defined for us, and they are merit and typology. I'm wondering if you can comment on those.
When we talk about merit within the document, we make a distinction between what we might call ex pacto or covenantal merit on the one side, or real or proper merit on the other side. And when we're talking about proper or real merit, that brings into view something unique to the work of Christ as the mediator. And the conditions of merit that we lay out for proper or real merit is this, that the work performed must be personal, one's own, perfect, without any flaw or defect, proportional, equal in value to the reward, non-indebted, not already owed to God, and performed by one's own strength. Now, those features are found only in the work of Christ as the mediator. What he does is personal and perfect. What he does is proportional. That is, what he accomplishes is equal to the value of the reward he receives, and it is not intrinsically owed to God. He does it freely, and he does it in his own strength. That's proper or real merit, and that does reflect a consensus within the historic Reformed tradition, and our committee believes that is intrinsic to the concepts of merit that are present in the standards. Now, what you get when you talk about improper merit or covenantal merit with Adam is something that's distinct. In the case of covenantal merit, you have a loose or improper use of merit language. Francis Turretin draws this distinction, for instance, in his Institutes. And so when Adam obeys God or offers on the hypothetical that he offers obedience required under the covenant of works, that obedience would have been perfect and personal. However, it would already be owed to God, indebted. It would be in no way equal to the promised reward, disproportionate, and it would require God's assistance and enabling to help perform it at every single point, right? Because he's a claimless creature of the dust. So two of the basic conditions of proper merit are present in covenantal merit, but three are not. And so we think that distinction between proper merit and covenantal merit is a critical distinction that helps us start to recognize that only Christ can offer meritorious obedience in the strict or proper sense of the term. Adam can offer ex pacto merit. And so, this is going to be a key. Those are the two species of merit that are reserved for federal heads: Adam's ex pacto covenantal merit, Christ's ex pacto real merit, merit in the proper sense of the term as we've just defined it. That's going to regulate a lot of the discussion, and it's going to provide a frame of reference for helping us see why what Israel as a redeemed people offers can neither be merit in the proper sense of the term reserved for Christ, nor can it be ex pacto merit that is reserved for Adam, because what Adam does in the covenant of works is devoid of redemptive grace. Adam is obeying perfectly and personally if he obeys, whereas after the fall, there is no perfect obedience by sinners, but only what is spirit-gifted, imperfect, and accepted for the sake of Christ. So that on the merit issue, I think that series of distinctions I just outlined is absolutely critical to grasp when you're trying to understand some of the nuances in this document. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very useful series of distinctions, because now if what Israel's doing is not real mm-hmm. merit, if it's not ex pacto merit, it's going to have to be a tertium quid. And it's going to have to be understood in terms of a reward that God would give a redeemed people according to a principle of grace by virtue of faith union with Christ. And so there are two notions of reward. There's meritorious reward, real Christ, ex pacto, or covenantal Adam. And then those are according to a principle where sinless federal heads are offering personal obedience. And then there's spirit-gifted obedience with Israel that is not meritorious in the proper sense. It's not meritorious in the ex pacto sense, but it functions in a way that is going to show some parallels between the two. And so once you start to understand that, you can start to see, I think, that within the confines of our confession, something what's happening with Israel, insofar as Israel must be a redeemed people, you cannot, and you if you want to use merit terminology to talk about what Israel's doing, you have to have very clear in your mind that Israel is not Christ and cannot offer covenantal real merit. Israel is not Adam and cannot offer covenantal ex pacto merit. Why? Because both Adam and Christ are sinless federal heads, Adam pre-fall, sinless federal heads who are offering a kind of obedience that's qualitatively distinct from the obedience of sinners. That insight right there, I think, really helps get us to the heart of what our confession teaches, Westminster 16, what our tradition teaches when it's talking about the Mosaic Covenant as an administration of the covenant of grace, and what one of the interpretations of Meredith Klein would have you see if you look at his work carefully.
That was very helpful, Lane. Thank you. If I could, just for the sake of our listeners and getting to the report and what I think is another very helpful perspective that is – or a very helpful characteristic of the report that I'd like for our listeners to look for when they're digging into it. And that's the taxonomy. You mentioned it briefly at the beginning here, but maybe if I could ask a twofold question, would you be able to articulate for us the different aspects of that taxonomy, and then perhaps highlight for us what the committee comes down on saying with regard to which of those particular views are, as it were, in bounds within the parameters of our confessional standards and which are not.
Very, very good. The taxonomy outlines, and there are other taxonomies that are out there. We found this one to be the most helpful, and I think it's the most comprehensive and detailed at the same time. The taxonomy outlines basically four different views under a twofold classification. Now, let me make clear this. There's a covenant of works, pure and simple, view one, mixed covenant, view two, subservient covenant, view three, and covenant of grace, view four. Now, the way our committee presented it and the way the taxonomy works is that views one through three view the covenant with the Mosaic covenant with Israel at the national level as essentially a covenant of works. That is, as a principle that operates independent of redemptive provision and does not have Christ as its substance. So in the covenant of works, pure and simple, it's basically the view that eschatological life is conferred for perfect, personal, exact, and entire obedience. The mixed covenant of view would say that you have that principle, pure and simple, but supplementing it, kind of a dialectical corollary of it, is a principle of grace. And they operate in some sort of parallel and separate way, but how they relate has never been really clearly held, articulated. Not a lot of people have held that view. The third view is the subservient covenant view, which says you have a non-redemptive, substantial works principle, but it's relegated not to eschatology, but to maintaining typical benefits. So that at the lower level, you have some kind of individual redemptive continuity with the Abrahamic and New Covenants, but the theocracy at the national level is exclusively governed by a works principle devoid of any redemptive grace, devoid of Christ the substance, and looks at maintaining typical blessings. Now, those three views, while distinguished from one another, fall under the view of saying that the Mosaic covenant at the national level is substantially a covenant of works. That is, it has a principle of obedience devoid of redemptive grace, of which Christ is not the substance. The fourth view says that the Mosaic covenant is substantially an administration of the covenant of grace at the national level on par with every other administration of the covenant of grace, whether it's Adamic, Noahic, Abrahamic, Davidic, or New, that there's a fundamental continuity of there's an organic, progressive, redemptive covenant of grace, and that is the substance of the Mosaic covenant at the national level. Now, what our committee, and this is our committee as a whole, without any qualification or dissent, what we came to conclude very clearly in light of our standards is that only that fourth view falls within the bounds of our standards. The room that is made is room for view four. Views one through three, according to our standards, are not a natural fit and therefore do not cohere with, do not comport with, and we, I don't want to use too strong a language, we would say are not consistent with the system of doctrine taught in the Westminster Standards. So that if you posit that the Mosaic Covenant at the national level is essentially a covenant of works, whether it be pure and simple, whether it be mixed, or whether it be subservient, those three views would fall under the substantial understanding of republication and, according to our report, would fall outside the boundaries of confessional orthodoxy. So that's the more narrow and specific sense in which room was given to people within the Orthodox Presbyterian Church here. So that's where the boundaries are. If you hold to a substantial view, views one through three, there is a great tension and perceived inconsistency with the standards. If you hold a view four, you're within the bounds and there's room within that context.
I'm thoroughly convinced of the fourth view, that the Mosaic Covenant is substantially a covenant of grace. And I've held to that view ever since coming to the Reformed faith and being taught that view in seminary. But there are two passages of Scripture in the New Testament in particular that I find very difficult to interpret. And maybe I can just bring them up and ask you if you can comment on them with regard to this idea. One text is in Luke chapter 10 and the other in Galatians chapter 4. The text in Luke 10 is the one in which Jesus responds to a lawyer who asks him the question, "What shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he said, "You shall love the Lord with all of your heart and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said, "You answered correctly, do this and you will live." Those words in particular, "do this and you will live," I have found difficult to interpret understanding the Mosaic Covenant as a substantive covenant of grace. The other text, of course, is in Galatians chapter 4. And when preaching through the book of Galatians, I found chapters 3 and 4 nearly incomprehensible. But chapter 4 in particular makes this distinction between two covenants. Paul gives this allegorical interpretation of the two women as two covenants. And so I'm wondering if you can just comment on one or both of those texts with regard to this idea as the Mosaic Covenant being a covenant of grace.
Oh, sure. Well, let me, if you don't mind, let me deal with Galatians 4. I'll try to say something about Luke 10 as well. I don't want to punt to a lecture I've done too much and depend on it, but I would like just to remind folks that I guess it was last year, I gave some lectures on 1 Corinthians 15 and 2 Corinthians 3. Comparing Adam and Moses to Christ, who is the Spirit. And the point that I made in 1 Corinthians 15 and 2 Corinthians 3 is that Paul has a comparative mode of argument by which he begins with the eschatological fullness of what comes in Christ as he is endowed with the Spirit, and the way that Christ advances as raised to glory and confers the Spirit of glory upon his church and brings to eschatological realization the mystery of God, the climax of redemptive history. He fulfills what is presented in shadowy form, and he does so by virtue of his being obedient to the point of death, vindicated as raised from the dead, receiving the Spirit and pouring the Spirit out on his church. Paul says that in relation to Adam, the relationship is such that Adam is like the body of death. He's a Soma Sukhikon. Sin accepted, of course, but he's a Soma Sukhikon. Christ is Soma Pneumatikon because Christ is life-giving spirit. What happens in the pre-fall order of Eden, though very good, is not yet the highest and fullest expression of what communion with God looks like. To that, you have to look to Christ. Also, with Moses, Paul compares letter and spirit, and he uses the same mode of argument. Christ is the spirit. As the spirit, he is the one in whom there is righteousness and life of the highest order. When you compare what Christ has done in his life, death, resurrection, and spirit endowment to what Moses did in Exodus 32 through 34, when he interceded for Israel, God heard Moses, God forgave Israel, God continued in a communion bond with Israel for Moses' sake. And Moses' face is transformed as a sign of God's presence in hearing Moses, who's a heightened type of Christ. What does Paul look back on that event and say, on that very event, and say? He says, it is death and condemnation. So that he uses this rhetorical device to say that whatever life and righteousness came under Moses' mediation and the transfigured countenance that attested to his mediatorial identity, to his heightened sense in which he's a type of Christ, it is as good as death and condemnation given the contrast with Christ to his life-giving spirit. What I tried to say at the end of the lecture was that something of the same rhetorical form appears in Galatians 4 when Paul reasons from Christ, who has been raised and spirit endowed, Galatians 4, 4 through 6. And when you compare what has come in him as he has been raised up to Zion, with the typological mode of grace that was revealed under Moses, the contrast is so extreme, so vast, that it's as good as being a different covenant. So that the same rhetorical device that Paul uses in 2 Corinthians 3, where he draws the contrast between the death and condemnation under the letter and the life and righteousness that is in Christ, that same kind of contrast is coming through in a different way when he talks about Sinai and Zion, and when he talks about these two different – so it's a rhetorical device that is of a piece with Paul's reasoning with Adam. Adam is Soma Sukhikon, not Soma Pneumatikon. Moses is condemnation and death, not righteousness and life. Sinai is a different covenant. How? In the way that none of those things compared with Christ, who is the Spirit, neither Adam nor the law can deliver what the Spirit in Christ delivers, which is access as sons of God into the eschatological fullness of Mount Zion. So see, it's in that sort of contrast I would also approach the text in Luke or any other text that we're talking about. And I look, none of this made it into the report. So that what you have in this is not necessarily something in the report. This is my exegetical reflection. But what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 15, 2 Corinthians 3, and Galatians 4 is draw a relative contrast using hyperbolic and rhetorical absolute terms. If you see that, this is on par with what we've been doing in the Voss group. If you see that point, you recognize that the quote-unquote law-gospel contrast is an eschatological and pneumatic contrast. That's what we're after there in those texts. And I actually don't know how to work all this back into the report except to say that this would be a line of exegetical reasoning to show why the Westminster Standards in 7.5, 7.6 say that the law-gospel contrast is between two administrations of the covenant of grace, not between an administration of the covenant of works, at Sinai, and the covenant of grace in the new.
Mm-hmm.
It's a redemptive historical, not a kind of forensic, abstract law gospel hermeneutic like you'd find in different species of evangelicalism and certain forms of Lutheranism.
So, that's fantastic. Thanks, Lane.
So we have here, you've established in the through the committee report that the fourth option in the taxonomy is what's acceptable, that the Mosaic covenant is substantially an administration of the covenant of grace, and that arises directly out of the standards, that language of substance. That's not an imposition that the committee has made or a word that the committee has adopted independent of the Westminster standards. It uses that language of substance to speak of the covenant here. So that's helpful. We've already now established the fact that since it is substantially a covenant of grace, that it's not based upon pure merit or strict merit according to the different types of merit that you've listed in the report and that the taxonomy and the glossary describe. Yet there is still a role in some sense for obedience among the nation. Can you describe in what way we can positively speak about works or a works principle or the role of obedience? What is the nature and role of obedience for the nation of Israel in the typological era?
Well, that kind of brings us, if it's okay for us to move to this, into the discussion of Klein. Conceptually, there have been two ways of understanding the works principle that Klein develops. It's this. On the one side, the works principle is a repristination or representation of a graceless covenant of works in Eden. And if I would have done something like this on the board at the General Assembly, I could have put it, and we could have put a diagram in, but I don't know how to do diagrams except on a chalkboard. but here's what you could do. On one interpretation of Klein, the works principle, you have box one, Eden. Box two, Abrahamic covenant. Box three, Mosaic covenant at the national level. On the first view, the substantial reading of Klein, you have an arrow that kind of rainbows from Eden over Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant and falls into the theocracy at the national level so that you get a represtination or a representation of a graceless Edenic works principle at the national level tethered to typical land maintenance. I don't know how else to say it. So think of it as the rainbow arrow that the trajectory is from Eden into the theocracy at the national level in absolute categorical qualitative contrast to the Abrahamic covenant. That's the what we could call a non-redemptive works principle tethered to national land maintenance. That would be the substantial view of Klein. Now, the administrative view would say this, that two key points, that the theocracy as a whole is a redemptive intrusion. Eden is a non-redemptive intrusion of the holiness of the age to come. The theocracy as a whole, according to Klein, is a redemptive intrusion of the age to come. It's a redemptive intrusion set over against a non-redemptive intrusion. So that what you do with Eden is you say it's a non-redemptive intrusion, protological. What you do with Canaan, you say it's a redemptive intrusion, typological. The second point, and this is key, the works principle that you have in Eden is redemptively recalibrated through the person and work of Abraham and is tethered not to the eschatological inheritance, as with Adam and Christ, but with the typical inheritance. And Klein appeals to Genesis 22:18 and Genesis 26:5 and shows that because Abraham obeys God, God will confer the typical kingdom upon his posterity. And so what is the nature of Abraham's obedience? Abraham's obedience, Klein says, is spirit-wrought ordinary obedience just like yours and mine, just like any other believers. Yet, Klein says, it is assigned a unique typico-symbolic function that approximates the merit of Christ as the mediator. So that built into Abraham's obedience is a redemptively recalibrated quote-unquote merit principle. And what is the works principle on the second view? Well, it's a principle that tethers imperfect spirit-wrought obedience to the typal kingdom. In Abraham's case, it's the tethering of obedience to the acquisition of the typical kingdom. In corporate Israel's case, it is the tethering of spirit-wrought, imperfect obedience to the maintenance of that typical holy realm. So that on this view, the works principle is redemptive, historically recalibrated through Abraham, and in that concrete way passes into the theocracy. So that you have an arrow of projection coming straight down, theocracy, and then the Abrahamic covenant, the line from Adam, passes through the Abrahamic covenant, is redemptively recalibrated in Abraham, and when redemptive intrusion meets Abraham's typical obedience, there you have a redemptive works principle. That's the second view of Klein that is advocated in this, and I would say I am not at liberty to really say more than what the committee as a whole would say about this, because we put two views out and set them out. But the first view of Klein would say that his views are outside the bounds, just like views 1 through 3 are. On the second view of Klein, the administrative view of Klein, we would say his views are not only within the bounds, but you could say that he's advancing some wonderful categories intrinsic to the standards in a Vossian redemptive historical trajectory. So he's not only within the bounds, but he is assisting us and helping us. So those are the two readings of Klein on the works principle. And because our committee didn't come out and say, there is a line that says the committee finds one view more persuasive than the other, but that's not for me to parse. But given the fact that you have those two views, I think readers would be very well instructed to think about those two ways of viewing Klein, and then just look at the report. Chase down the resources and think through the Klein's corpus. Give it a real careful read. Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to tell us a little bit about, some thoughts on Westminster Confession 19, how the report parses that out and understands the law that is articulated there, especially as it's language of republication and things like that.
Yeah, I would love to. Let me just say this. I'm very sentimental about my time at Westminster West up to 1998, sat under Klein, Clowney, Robert Strimple, of course. And Robert Strimple, I think I've got some material that he's written on this. I really came to think Strimple had just nailed this. Robert Strimple on Westminster Confession 19. Said that the basic distinction to appreciate is that the law as a covenant of works operates in Eden, but it does not operate in the theocracy under the Mosaic covenant. Instead, it operates as a rule of life. And the distinction is basically this, that God requires perfect, personal, exact, and entire obedience of all his creatures in every covenantal administration, whether you're talking covenant of works or at various administrations of the covenant of grace. But the law does not serve as a covenant of works under the covenant of grace. It serves as a rule of life. Now, we do a lot. I think this is an excellent – I think all the sections are very, very helpful. But there's a very helpful discussion on some of the details of reading the standards on this particular point. And let me just say this to put it in a little bit different nomenclature that might help people see where we're going. When you talk about the law as it is presented again on Sinai, what the report's getting at is this, that when and we've just talked about this with Voss and the Voss group, so this might overlap. People might find this useful. What you get in the giving of the Decalogue, the law on Sinai, is a context that is so deeply, so ubiquitously, so undeniably redemptive that you see an indicative, imperative relationship. I am the Lord your God who brought you by blood out of bondage, out of Egypt. I have hovered over you. I've recreated you. I have redeemed you. And now I am bringing a mediator up before me, and I'm going to give you a gracious, redemptively qualified imperative called the Decalogue. And that is a rule of life for those who have been brought into a redemptive communion bond with God. And it's not, you see, some kind of aberrant, retrograde, graceless works principle, a covenant of works, and our standards are exceptionally clear on that point. So that language, I think, is very useful. I know there have been some readings of the Westminster Standards within the past decade that have tried to take that language to be that in Westminster Confession 19:1-3, that the Mosaic, that the law is a covenant of works for Israel, but the syntax of the chapter does not support that. The document makes it very clear that you're really dealing with the indicative imperative relationship under a covenant of grace. And I just, we didn't quote anything that Strimple had ever written, but it just reminded me what we said, reminded me of his just such helpful work on that point. And I find that to be a very important section in our standards. Because if you understand Westminster Confession 19 properly, that the law is the way of life. It is a rule of life, not a covenant of works. And secondly, if you understand that God rewards the obedience of believers, not according to a principle of merit, but he rewards their imperfect, sincere, spirit-wrought obedience for the sake of Christ and union with him. You get those two principles down. You are just about clear. And I would say fundamentally going to move in the right direction in assessing this particular question. And so that section there on Westminster 19, I think, is just highly useful.
Lane, so we have this report now. I find it extremely helpful, very thankful for it, and I'm glad that it's going to be distributed and is being distributed to people so they can read it, learn it. It's useful for presbyteries, for credentialing, for all sorts of other things. How would you suggest that this report be used, not just administratively, no pun intended, but to speak of how a presbytery might consider a candidate for ordination or for licensure, but how ought it to be used even perhaps in a practical way and in day-to-day ministry? Does it have a bearing and a place there?
Yeah, first, in terms of day-to-day bearing and maybe preaching, I think the document gives you some wonderful parameters for understanding the role of redemptive typology in the history of special revelation. I think it can help you kind of get your bearings on how to preach the uniqueness of Israel and the way Israel reenacts the sin-fallen exile of Adam without being an Adam figure, without being confused with either the first or last Adam. It really, I think, can help people preach in a way that talks about rewards for obedience without merit being involved for believers. I think it helps you understand typology and the law-gospel distinction. I think if you understand this document, you can preach the law-gospel distinction in a redemptive historical way and not a bare, abstract, forensicentric, or Lutheran way. I think there's just no end to the value that the document can have in that way. Now, secondly, to what use is the document to be put? Well, Chad Van Dixhorn said something at the General Assembly I found useful, not to be too self-aggrandizing about the committee's work, but let's just say it's something like this, that now that some clarity has been offered in a manner similar to but far less significant than, say, Nicaea. What you can do is, just as after Nicaea you could look back on Christological formulations and see weaknesses and problems and give people the opportunity to clarify themselves and say, you know what, I don't think I want to say it that way. I think I'd rather put it this way in light of what this committee has said. I think in light of what the council has said, I think something similar can happen here. I think that people who have been looking to – see, here's the thing. There's something really unique about the Mosaic Covenant at the national level. There's something unique about the way Adam's sin, fall, and exile is presented. Now, what the report has done is really tried to fine-tune and crystallize precisely what is unique about that in a way that preserves the distinction between the creator and the creature, between federal heads and redeemed sinners, and the clarity that I think the document has given us should be used in this way. It shouldn't be used to go witch hunting and saying to people, you're out, get out of here. I've seen what you've printed in the past, get out of here. Rather, it could be used in this way. You can go to brothers in Christ and say, hey, as we've gained clarity on this issue, is what you're after best captured by saying there is an indirect redemptive reenactment of the sin, fall, and exile of Adam at the theocratic level? And if people say that, I think that's good. But I would say this. I do think a time is coming, and maybe at hand, where people who have misled or been unclear in the past and maybe helped precipitate this controversy, I think it's time to say in print, hey, I'd like to qualify and clarify what I've said so that I'm not advocating a substantial view of republication. I'm actually advocating an administrative view. And in these places where I was unclear, let me now offer some additional clarification, perhaps retraction, perhaps some significant modifications due. And I think we ought to give people time to do that. But I do think people ought to try to do that. I think they ought to try to clarify what they've said in the past using this document. And I think it affords the opportunity for that kind of candor and honesty. I know it could be a little hard. It can be a little difficult. It's hard to go back and maybe say, I need to say this differently. But I think this document should give us an opportunity where we have the room to say that. And in light of the report, clarify some things that were not as clear as they were in the past, and maybe modify, maybe even change some things that had been put in print in the past for the sake of Christ and His church. I hope our document report serves that purpose.
That's very helpful. Thanks for that, Lane. I do encourage people to take a look at the report. We'll have all the appropriate links as well as some supporting resources provided for in the episode description. You can find all this in your podcast app or online at reformedforum.org. Of course, encourage you to visit all the news and to read the updates at opc.org for the pertinent materials. And we want you also to follow up with us. If you have any questions or comments, you can get a hold of us at mail@reformedforum.org or by tweeting us @reformedforum. I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.